Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
As a show dedicated to the hospitality industry, I'm so excited to introduce our new podcast sponsor, Talk. Talk is your all-in-one platform for reservations, takeout, and event management. Reach millions of guests, eliminate no-shows, and drive revenue for your business. Make the switch to Talk today at exploretalk.com/join.
This week on Meet and Three, we're foraging. From Prospect Park to an iPhone app, what does it mean to find our own food?
We've recorded, I think, over 1,300 species of fungi occurring in New York City.
You know, my ingredients are making themselves, and so that rather than having the stress of needing to source the things I need, I can just walk out my back door and I can have them.
Foraging overall is born out of living with the land and with the seasons by indigenous people.
Tune in to Meetin' 3, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. It is Wednesday, June 23rd, 2021. This is our 293rd episode of this series, which is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talent in the hospitality industry. Today, my guest is a chef and entrepreneur with a game-changing recipe tool for professional chefs, and I'll introduce him fully in a moment. First, as I do on every show, I will start out with my PR tip. And then later, we will have my speed round game, industry news discussion, solo dining experience, and the final question. As the founder of Bayer Public Relations, I'm going to tip the show off with my PR tip of the week. So today's tip is to utilize the right tools. Whether it's an app or website or physical tool, finding the perfect instruments for you and your business is key to success. Tools can not only make your job more efficient, but save time and money. So do your research and find what works best for your needs. And if by chance what you're looking for doesn't exist, then of course you can invent it. That's my tip today. Now I'm thrilled to have my guest joining me. It is Josh Sharkey. He is the founder and CEO of Mies, the recipe tool for professional chefs. Josh has over 15 years of experience as a chef, from Michelin star restaurants in Norway to working with some of the best chefs in New York City, including Grey Coons, David Boulay, and Floyd Cardoz. In 2009, he opened his first solo project, a fast casual concept called Bark Hot Dogs, which received many accolades, including Best Hot Dog in New York by New York Magazine. And in 2020, Josh launched Mies after 2 years of development, inspired by the same principles applied to great cooking, an uncompromising attention to detail, and a constant drive to evolve and improve. So without further ado, hi, Josh. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Sherry. And thank you for the kind intro.
Oh, you're very welcome. I mean, it's the short bio, but I tried to get in there, you know, a bunch of highlights because you certainly have done and accomplished a lot. So let's go back to your background a little bit and tell me where you grew up and what inspired you to get into cooking and the hospitality industry.
Sure. Well, I grew up in Northern Virginia. And, you know, I really started cooking at a young age because my father had passed away when I was 16. And so I was, you know, cooking dinner for the family. That's kind of how sort of kickstarted cooking more as a necessity, but then sort of grew into, an interest, which grew into a passion, which then eventually grew into a love. But really the impetus for kind of what became my career was just starting to cook for the family. And, you know, I can sort of go into some more of the background of, you know, my early years of cooking before I moved to, you know, Norway and then New York. But that's how it started.
So, and you decided to go to cooking school?
Yeah, so I was sort of deciding between wrestling in college. So I got a couple of scholarships to wrestle or going to cooking school.
Wow.
And then
that's impressive.
I decided that I found a way to do both because it turned out that Johnson and Wales had a pretty good wrestling team. Now they have an incredible wrestling team. But that culinary school, the coach had reached out to me because of an article he saw in the Washington Post from when I was in high school about my wrestling career and how I wanted to cook. And so he worked out a way where I could get a scholarship to go to Johnson and Wales. And so I ended up going there for culinary school.
Wow, I did not know that about Johnson and Wales.
Yeah, they actually won. I mean, the coach Lonnie is incredible, and it was actually his first year when I started there, and they were number one, the number one wrestling team in America from D2, and I think they're just it's an incredible program actually, which you would not think of when you think of culinary school, but Johnson and Wales, you know, has a whole university. So,
yeah, I did not know. Good to know. So take us through a little bit of your cooking history, because I mean the chefs from your bio that you've worked with are extremely credible chefs. Was anyone in particular strongly a mentor for you, or what were your takeaways from working with all these
great? Well, I think I learned, you know, a lot from each of the chefs that I worked for, all different things from each chef, and some things were more sort of, the takeaway was something that was more culinary, and sometimes the takeaway was more sort of life-based or work-based, but really they, you know, each of the restaurants that I worked at, each experience kind of, you know, helped shape, you know, who I am today. I will say that Greg Kuntz, you know, I spent the most time with Chef Kuntz, and he probably had the biggest impact on my career, you know, as a chef and the way that I thought about food. But also, you know, Floyd Cardoz was an amazing sort of, you know, mentor and also inspiration for how important it is to be an incredible cook as well as an incredible chef. And Floyd was both of those things. One of the best line cooks I've ever seen is actually him, and an incredible chef. So, you know, I think each restaurant was sort of a learning experience in itself of everything from business to culinary. I'm happy to sort of dig into any of those, but
it's I'm sure. Yeah, takeaways from all of them. Really wonderful chefs to work for. So when did you get the idea for Bark Hot Dogs? And did you think? I mean, back when you were going to cooking school, did you think one day you would want to have your own restaurant?
Well, I always knew I wanted to have my own business. You know, and it became a restaurant once I started cooking. But even before that, when I was much younger, I wanted my own business. And then, of course, once I got into sort of the restaurant industry, I did always want to have a restaurant. You know, it didn't really spark until, you know, the thought that I could actually go and do it until much later in my career. But really, the idea for Bark came much earlier than the inception of it. When I was at Tabla, another cook there, this guy named Brandon Gillis, who's also a really tremendous cook and chef, and he was one of the founding chefs at this place called Franny's in Brooklyn, and now he's got a bunch of restaurants called Fiorella out in San Francisco. But him and I, well, we lived right behind each other, but we also were, you know, became fast friends and sort of drew up this idea. Really, more he was sort of the bigger inspiration in the beginning, but the idea of like, can we just disrupt fast food, right? Can we change the perception of fast food in America? Because at the time we lived in Park Slope, Brooklyn, and there was nothing, you know, it was just all sort of, you know, the typical fast food that you think of. And, you know, just like any sort of business, we thought, well, you know, why can't there be really great fast food that doesn't have this sort of connotation that fast food in America has? And so that was sort of what sparked it. It took a long time after that for us to actually start to work on that plan. I left Tabla and went to Boulay and then went to Cafe Grey. And, you know, so it was years later before we actually started working on the plan. But the inspiration was really, you know, just creating a new way to think about fast food.
Yeah, well, I mean, and it was, I remember going and taking a trip out to BARC because you got a tremendous amount of wonderful press and really well received. And I wanted to check it out. And I remember going and it being fantastic. And what was your experience like as a chef owner? And then why did you ultimately decide to close after, I don't, how many years were you?
8 years. Around for 8 years. The experience was, it was an incredible and also just tremendous learning experience. You know, owning anybody that owns a restaurant, whether they're a chef or not, can sort of attest to is a lot more than just cooking. And so that was, we learned that fast, is that we had to, really create really, really tight systems. The learning curve, was almost immediate where we realized, like, we're not going to get the same cooks that we get at these fine dining restaurants. So if we don't create really dialed in process, then we're not going to, execute the food that we want to execute. And so that was both a tough learning experience and also a really inspiring one, because it sort of one of the sort of kind of elements to what later became Yeez. I really loved the idea that we could, one, sort of, create a new sort of, channel of sort of food that didn't exist, that where people could sort of bring their kids and feel good about it. But we could also, take, kids that had zero cooking experience and introduce them to techniques that they would never see, unless they, worked at, Michelin star restaurants, but do it in a way where they have sort of a process that they can follow to execute well. And that was probably one of the best takeaways I had as an owner of the business. And the reason for closing, there's a couple reasons. One, with just some real estate issues we had in Manhattan that honestly legally I can't talk about, but it was a bit of a bummer. And most importantly, just I had an itch that I had to scratch. Me started becoming more and more and more of a thing that I really knew I wanted and needed to build. And I was at a sort of a pivotal moment where I knew I needed to either raise more capital to grow BARC, or I needed to go in another direction. And I decided that I really was more passionate about building this new sort of product in Yeez. And also sort of I realized that I would have a much bigger impact, or I had the opportunity to have a much bigger impact on the industry if I could execute Yeez the way that with the vision that I had, than I would have as as a restaurant owner or operator.
Yeah. So tell us a bit. Let's get into Yeez. Like you touched on when this, you started thinking of this idea, but when did you feel it was going to be like you were going to go all in entrepreneurial, creating like into the tech space? I mean, from being a chef and owner, it's challenging, I would assume.
they're very different industries. They're also very similar. I knew that I had to do it. It was an itch that I knew I had to scratch, but I didn't really put pen to paper, as they say, or like really start even thinking about building it until I did a lot of, a lot of research, asking, all my friends, all my sort of, every sort of chef I knew in my network, what are they doing? How are they solving this problem? What are they using to store and manage their recipes? And it was a long time before I really decided, okay, this is a business that's worth doing. And I know, how I need to do it. So that was really, I think at that point, that was really when I had decided, to close BARC, because I had done enough of that where I knew there was something there and I needed to really, if I was going to do it, I needed to dive in, wholeheartedly.
Yeah. So with, first with the name, did that just, how did you think? I know it comes from mise en place or mise en place, but, was that something that came right away? And what were you with your recipes before you started creating this tool? Like, how were you typically keeping your recipes? And why did you see it needed? You needed to create something that for a better system.
Yeah, well, I mean, so two questions there. The name, I love four-letter words, so I knew it had to be something like that. BARC was actually a combination of Brandon, my business partner, everybody called B, and everybody calls me Shark or Sharky, and so B, Shark, BARC, we kind of like that's how that came to be. And Mies was really, it was kind of a no brainer. Like, I don't think I even came up with any other names. You know, Mies en Place is such a, you know, such a powerful sort of, not just phrase, but it means so much to us as chefs, you know, because it really is a true measure of like how we operate. And I knew that's, you know, something that I wanted to make sure was, it was always sort of part of the ethos of how we built. And I wanted to make sure it was a name that was evocative of the culinary industry. I think that a lot of sort of, the technology that we were in the beginning trying to sort of, you know, separate ourselves from, was really back office accounting type software. And that was very clearly sort of, you know, finance and accounting driven. And so I wanted to make sure that we had a name that very clearly, you know, stated like, hey, this is a tool for chefs, specifically for chefs, for culinary professionals, and, you know, and you know, remove any need for doubt there.
And then I did throw in there a second question with just like, how are you organizing your recipes before, and why feel this need to create a tool to be better organized?
Yeah, I mean, look, that's why we built Mies, is because of the answer to that question, which is a cluster, you know, it was everywhere. Word docs, spreadsheets, you know, Google Docs, Evernote, notebooks, you know, binders, you know, web pages, you know, everywhere you can think of, because they, and on top of that, you know, because in a business operation, you also need to deploy this recipe information into other sort of, you know, verticals of your business, whether it's you need inventory, you need purchasing, or you need, you know, menu data. That recipe would also have to live in, you know, in an inventory system, and also need to possibly live in a POS system, and maybe it needs to live in your training system as well. And so it was really, you know, the problem that we're really trying to solve at the heart of this is you know, your recipe should live in one place. There should be one source of truth. And right now in the industry, that's just not the case. And I think that's what we're really trying to do, is sort of like gobble up all those recipes from all the disparate places that they live and centralize it in one place for you, where you can still sort of, you know, push that information to other, you know, to other places. And so at this point now, I can confidently say like all my recipes from everywhere I've ever been live in Mies. It took a while to get them in there.
How many recipes is that?
Thousands, you know, there's thousands of recipes there. And, you know, there's a, I think we actually even included on our site here, but like, the novel idea of Mies originally came, you know, back in 2002 or something. I was when I was working at Tabula, I also worked for free in the mornings for Mario Batali's salumi, company in the Italian wine merchant's shop, this chef named Dan Latham. And I had this notebook of literally every single, you know, recipe. And when I say recipe, I mean time, temperature, humidity, you know, color, you know, moisture, all these things that, that went into, you know, making the charcuterie, and, you know, little notes and drawings of how to tie the knots and things like that. And I had this notebook packed with all those things as well as like all these ideas. And I was, one day, I was staging at this restaurant Veritas on my day off, and I lost the freaking notebook. And so I lost all of that stuff. And so the novel idea originally was, you know, I wanted a digital place to store all my recipes. Granted, that was back in 2002 and Evernote didn't exist, or I didn't know about it. So that was really the original sort of, you know, idea behind it, was just the cloud for your recipes.
Yeah, well, I could see that being a motivation. I'm sorry. I feel badly.
Never got those back either. Although, funny enough, Chef Dan, we reconnected recently. He's actually using Mies and is a great ambassador of it. And I'm going to slowly start hitting him up for some of the stuff that he taught me back then.
Wow. Well, yeah. Well, so let me ask you my question from my last guest. On episode 292, I had on Ellen Yin. She's the co-founder and owner of High Street Hospitality Group, which includes A Kitchen Plus Bar, Fort, High Street Philly, and High Street Provisions in Philadelphia, and High Street on Hudson in Manhattan. So she wants to know, how did you get buy-in from your first chef? What kind of pushback did you get, and how did you overcome it? She said she sees me as being a great recipe tool.
Yeah, well, I think the problem originally was I just got I just got complete buy-in when it was an idea, you know, because I would talk to my friends and say, hey, I have this idea of a better way to like store all of our recipes and here's what I'm thinking. And they're like, oh, that's awesome. So in the beginning, you know, it was easy. Now, you know, the caveat here is that, you know, like for some reason I have a habit of choosing businesses or problems that are really, really hard to solve. And once I realized the vision for me is the full vision, you know, I realized that like our, we have to, and there's an internal metric in our team and the way we think about sort of developing is like, we have to be 10 times better than Google Sheets and Google Docs and things like that, because that's what people use today and they're used to it. And it is pretty easy to use those things. So it was really challenging in the beginning. Honestly, we pissed off a lot of my, you know, friends and chefs because it just wasn't there yet, right? It was, we knew it had the opportunity to be there, but there's a lot of things that we had to do to improve the, you know, the app to get it there. So in the beginning, you know, we got a lot of pushback. But I think the most important thing that I learned was sort of how to sort of filter out the feedback and really sort of try to distill down like the problem that their chefs, you know, were having and not really you know, the feature or the sort of surface level thing that they were sort of, you know, talking about. Because at the end of the day, like all we're trying to solve problems and, you know, sometimes features and technology do that. Sometimes something else does. But now I think, you know, and I say this just honestly, because it's just, I mean, it's really, I'm proud of my team for being such a big part of this, is that honestly, when we demo Mies, when we show the tool to a chef, we have like a 99%, you know, conversion rate where like, you know, it's almost, we haven't had a chef yet where they see the platform and they're like, I'm not sure. Like it's like immediate buy-in because it's so obvious that, you know, that we've taken all this feedback over the last, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years and instilled it into this product that just clearly says like, hey, this is built for us by us. And I think, now we get really, really, really great buy-in. I think the biggest, you know, challenge we have is just to get it in front of as many chefs as possible.
Yeah, well, that's amazing. And I mean, you're coming from, you're a chef yourself, you're a restaurateur, like, you know, you created something that would be useful, you know, based on your experience. So I think it's really, I would trust you in developing this product. And then the fact that when you're showing it to people, it's just an instant sell. That's amazing. I guess, you know, the first question people might ask is, well, how do I get all my recipes in there? And I think you've created it. So there's lots of ways, right? Has the recipes on a notebook or an Excel sheet, it doesn't matter. Right. Is that correct?
Exactly. That's a big part of, and a learning lesson up front. Although it was sort of always part of the plan, but we knew it was going to be a big lift, is, you know, half of our time is spent on how do we make sure the experience is incredible and is easy and is, you know, fluent and fluid to use this product. And the other half of the time is how quickly can we take all this random recipe information that people have and get it into Mies. And so we have a lot of technology built around how to do that, right? So you can, you know, we spent a lot of time sort of ingesting recipes from every format that you can think of, so that now you can, import a recipe. It doesn't matter if it's a Word doc or a spreadsheet or a PDF or an Excel doc, and it can be imported into Mies, and we can normalize all the information so that it's structured into the Mies, you know, into the Mies database. And that's because, partly because we track the delta between kind of what was entered and what the actual output is. So the system is constantly learning different ways that we say the word gram, or different ways we spell onion, or different iterations of a pickle liquid. And so we can deploy machine learning to constantly, you know, improve the system. So if, you know, 9 months ago, you entered gram and you spelled it a certain way, it might have an error. Now that just doesn't happen. And it just keeps getting, you know, it keeps getting smarter. And the idea here is that it doesn't matter how great our system is. If you have 1,000 recipes and you need to get them in, well, it's got to be easy. And so that's a big part of what we do. And we actually, even though it's easy to enter them in yourself, we have a service that a lot of restaurants and chefs, you know, take advantage of, where we'll upload the recipes for them. And, you know, a big part of the technology is really, you know, I was fortunate enough to, while, you know, while I had the idea for Mies, and while I, as soon as I realized like the importance of a database, which, you know, was about 7 years ago, and because I had restaurants that I owned and then a restaurant group that I was, you know, able to run, you know, we spent 7 years developing and testing this database of thousands of ingredients so that if you add a brunoise shallot or a sliced rainbow carrot or, you know, a quarter cup of dark rye flour or a Balsam or something, all of those conversions of how much that cup weighs and about how much loss if you brunoise the shallot or if you juice the celery, it's all built into the app. So as soon as you take your sort of static, you know, recipe information from whatever document it's in, it's not only sort of uploaded into Mies really quickly, but it's also now it's dynamic. You know, you can scale it, you can convert things, you can share it, all that kind of stuff. So that's the fun part for, you know, for us is like, how can we keep digging into that and making it really, you know, faster and easier?
Yeah, that's amazing. Who are some of the chefs that are on board? And I know when you were doing some testing, you were working with the Orify restaurant group, which has a lot of very successful more fast casual concepts. I don't know if you want to talk.
Sure. About yeah. That. Yeah. We built a lot of Mies while I was the chief operating officer of Orify. So obviously all the brands within Orify are using Little Beat Table, Feels Good Chicken, Le Pain Quotidien is using it all across America. And then, you know, we have tons and tons of chefs and restaurants across the country. Well, you know, across the world. I think we're in now like, you know, 9 countries. Obviously USA, Canada, Mexico, Australia, UK, but even like Thailand, Japan, Korea, things like that. But, you know, the type of businesses really like spread the gamut between, you know, fast casual, full service, you know, fine dining restaurants to, you know, catering companies and meal kit companies. You know, I never know which ones to mention because I love them all, but you know, there's a lot of the chefs maybe that, you know, the people know here, like Dan Kluger and Franklin Becker and Akhtar and, you know, Rocco Spirito, and then, you know, restaurants like Maria, and Sullivan Street Bakery, things like that, Polo Bar, you know, and there's a lot of places out west like She-Wolf and things like that. There's tons of them. And we also, you know, I'll sort of spare the too much details because we're going to make a bigger announcement, but we're also powering, you know, culinary curriculum software for a really incredible culinary school as well that we've partnered with. So we really, you know, we sort of say if you're a business that takes cooking seriously, then Mies is really, you know, meant for you.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think you also have Sullivan Street Bakery.
Absolutely.
I'll give them a shout out because I work with Jim Leahy. So, all right.
The bread is amazing.
In the past. And I know, yeah. So that's, yeah, you have, yeah, that's an incredible list of people. And I look forward to your announcement. You launched in 2020. We know what last year, it's a hard time to launch. Well, I know you were working on this for many years before, but tell us a bit about how this past year has been with the pandemic and how you got through it.
I mean, yeah, look, it's been crazy. Not to mention I had my second kid recently, which is sort of,
oh wow,
completely underestimated the amount of time that two kids takes over one. but you know, so the pandemic has had so many sort of so much impact on so many, you know, parts of, you know, not just my life, but the company and my team, and you know how we are able to, you know, now work remote and the learning experience behind that. But when the pandemic, I mean, I think all of us probably remember the day. I specifically remember the day that my team went home. It was Thursday, March 12th, I think, and or 16th, I don't remember the day. But like,
yeah, it was the 12th. Was a Thursday.
Yeah, and you know, we left that day, and we're like, well, I'll see you in a week or two when this dies down. And obviously, it didn't. And then literally, like, I think 2 or 3 weeks later, as more and more of my friends and colleagues started mentioning, like, hey, this is, like, I started to hear the problems that were getting more and more serious. Like, what are we going to do? Like, we, you know, still got to pay our bills. We still have all this. I paused the launch of Mies. We were originally going to launch in, I think, June of last year. And instead, we pivoted and we basically, you know, I had my development team just stop what they were doing and build a home version of the Mies app. And we started this thing called Recipes for Relief, where we essentially built a brand new sort of like home version of the app and then allowed chefs to create recipes and recipe books and sell them to the public, and the public could kind of like pay what they want. And then 100% of the proceeds went back to the chefs. So we helped, you know, chefs raise, you know, thousands of dollars for their businesses or for themselves if they were, you know, if they were out of work. And that was, you know, that was incredible. It also sort of surfaced a lot of things that we knew we had to, you know, that we had to improve in the app, because there was a lot of people. We went from, you know, very few people using it outside of our beta customers to thousands of people using it. And that obviously like illuminated a lot of things that we had to sort of, you know, adjust. But it was, you know, it was just, you know, the pandemic was really like a way to see there's no North Star, like everything, you know, everything can change. Everything is new. And, you know, and honestly, a part of me loves that, because I love the idea of having to sort of change the way we think. And part of it was really traumatic. You know, we lost, I'm sure a lot of us lost, you know, some people that we really love. I lost, you know, friends and family. And of course, you know, the terrible loss of Chef Floyd and Chef Kuntz, you know, through that time was just, you know, just immense. But, you know, I think it really did help sort of callous our, you know, all of us and our team and come out stronger in the end. And I think now we're also, even as a product, much, much better because of it.
Yeah. Well, it's wonderful you did that, and smart that, you know, in helping out chefs, it's really, really great. And yeah, it seems, I guess we're starting to see the light at the end of this dark year.
Hope so.
How many people are on your team now?
We have, I'm so bad at answering that question, but we have about 13 developers, and then I always count on my hand. That's how many there are, right? 13 developers, and then, you know, 2, 3. So another 7 on top of the 30. So call it 20. 20 people.
Well, okay. That's, you're counting on your toes too then. Before we take a break, like what's your vision now, or where do you want a company to grow? Are you thinking you're going to have like, you know, 100 employees or, you know?
Yeah. I mean, look, my vision is only just getting started, honestly. Like we've had in the past 6 months, we've had over 700% growth, in a very short period of time. So we're growing really, really fast, which is great, but it's also means that we really need to I really need to speed up all the things that I want to build for this, you know, for this technology. But for me, my vision is really, you know, I always sort of like refer to this, is that, you know, it always bugs me that, you know, that designers have, you know, Figma or Adobe, and photographers have Photoshop, and architects have AutoCAD, and chefs, you know, we don't have anything. And so I really want to, this is what I want to give to our industry, is like a tool that's for us, that's built for us, that is, you know, all the feedback comes from us. And so there's so much more that we want to do with the technology. You know, we have a big launch coming now with automated allergy nutrition, but, you know, the way in which you scale, the way in which you can sort of interact with the app to do R&D, and the way in which you can, you know, iterate on recipes. There's so much more that we want to build. And so we have, it's exciting, but, you know, we have a long way to go.
Yeah, well, it is exciting, and look forward to your future, the future. So on that note, let's take a little break and we'll come back. We'll play my speed round game. We'll talk some industry news. I have a solo dining experience this week as usual, and the final question. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. As we know, and we often discuss here on my podcast, running a restaurant is no easy feat. Talk is your solution. It's built by passionate restaurateurs for the ever-changing hospitality industry, and it's the world's only unified reservation, takeout, and event management platform. Many of the restaurants that I work with in PR and restaurants that I dine at use Talk to offer special tastings, book their chef's counters, manage their alfresco dining, and host events. Just the other day, I was on Talk and I booked a solo open-air dining reservation at one of my favorite seasonal waterfront spots in New York City, Grand Banks. I can't wait to go. And I recently scored a reservation at Wiley Dufresne's Hot New Stretch Pizza at Bread's Bakery, also on Talk. Plus, my hospitality clients love dreaming up ideas for the platform, as Talk allows them to easily manage them and drive revenue. And look, we know that change happens on the fly. With Chalk, you can easily and rapidly update offerings, floor plans, and pacing in real time. So take control of your business. Make the switch to Chalk today to reach millions of guests and drive more revenue. Learn more at exploretalk.com/join. That's exploretalk.com/join. exploretalk.com/join. Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest today is Josh Sharkey. He's the founder and CEO of MEEZ. That's M-E-E-Z. And it's the recipe tool for professional chefs. So Josh, it's time for my speed round game. What this is I'm going to name a couple things and you get to pick your preference, such as chocolate or vanilla. You ready?
I am. And I have at all times chocolate in front of me at my desk. So if that question was one, it's chocolate.
All right. That's the bonus. And I'm with you on that. I love chocolate. okay, here we go. Eat in or eat out?
Well, I mean, right now it's eat in. But that might change in the next few months.
Okay. How about wine, beer, cocktail, mocktail, or champagne?
I am a bourbon guy.
Ooh, good to know. Tasting menu or a la carte?
Depends on the restaurant. Typically a la carte, though.
Small plates or large plates?
Small plates.
Communal table or chef's counter?
Chef's counter.
Tipping or all-inclusive charge?
Tipping.
Hot dogs or hamburgers?
That's a terrible one to ask me because I'm going to say hamburgers.
I'm sorry, say it again.
I'm going to say hamburgers, which I feel terrible saying, but it's, you know.
Oh, I was thinking that was an easy one and you were going to go the other way.
Yeah. Well, I ate enough hot dogs in my day where, you know, I think I'm past it.
Okay. Following a recipe to a T or winging it?
The first time and after that, winging it. So first time I would follow it. Well, that's how I would, like, I tell people to do that and then wing it after that. I think for myself, I typically just look for inspiration and recipes and then, you know, make my own. But
yeah, well, that's smart, I think. Okay. Two more: cheese plate or dessert?
Dessert. Oh my gosh. Dessert. I can say that 12 more times. It would be dessert, 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 dessert.
Cool. Manhattan or Brooklyn?
Can you be more specific? Just in general, Manhattan or Brooklyn?
Okay. Then I'll do Columbus Circle or Park Slope.
I'm going to say Columbus Circle just because of the nostalgia of Cafe Grey.
Oh, wow. Yeah. You know, I dined there once when in Time Warner Center and it was amazing.
Any dishes stick out to you?
You know, it's funny you ask because typically my memory is not very good. And this is why I love taking photos of food and Instagram because I can look back. However, I do remember, what was it? A mushroom. What's the signature mushroom dish?
The risotto.
Okay. I remember that. And I remember the presentation of it too. And that was phenomenal.
Yep. It's got the little mushroom sauce and it's like a Swiss style risotto where there's a lot of like butter that cooked with it the whole time. That's an incredible one.
Were you in charge of that station?
I was not. I worked Saucier and then in the meat station and then as a sous chef. But I can think of a bunch of people that were on that station that have a lot of memories of cooking a lot of risotto and searing off a lot of mushrooms before service. I did make the mushroom sauce for that dish though.
Yeah.
Shout out to Tin Ho on teaching me the proper way to strain a mushroom stock. I always remember that.
Oh, really cool. Yeah. And I just feel fortunate I got the opportunity to dine there. It was a while ago.
Yeah. And we I think we're trying to do something, soon to, you know, to give back and support the Kuntz family. I just really love them, and obviously like had such a deep love for Chef Kuntz and what he did for the industry. I think, you know, he just had such a, him and Floyd both had such an incredible impact on our industry, and I think that really inspires me to, you know, to hopefully do, you know, to do better every day because of what they've done for us.
Yeah, it's great. It's really nice that you had the opportunity to work with both of them. Like, I think it's special. So, okay. So industry news this week, the article I picked out was in the New York Times, and it's entitled "Grocery to Table is a Challenge for Restaurants in the Pandemic. Looking for new ways to get their food to customers, chefs are reinventing their dishes as retail offerings, and it can be tricky." And this was by Jane Black. So, I mean, this, I just thought this was, you know, interesting, or at least to highlight that this, you know, the restaurants they pointed out in this article, one of them is Little Sesame in Washington, D.C., and I've actually been there. It's really great, fast casual concept. They were starting to try to retail their hummus and realizing that it's kind of trickier or harder to just take your product and go put it as a grocery store product, just the challenges of it. But I think chefs, including these guys, started doing it as another source of revenue during the pandemic. But I think from the article, it said it took them about a year to actually get their products in a store.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't get a chance to read that article, but, you know, I have a lot of experience, you know, creating CPG products and that process. And there's a lot that goes into it, and independent of all of the regulatory things that go into it and schedule process and all that jazz, you know, it's just a different sort of way of thinking about how you cook the food, right? Because you're, you know, in the restaurant, we sort of put a plate of food out, and there's a different sort of, you know, shelf life. There's a different atmosphere. There's a different temperature. It's on a plate. There's a lot that we can garnish it. We can, there's a lot of things that you can do to control it in a restaurant setting, and you give up all of that control, you know, when it goes, into retail. There's just a completely different sort of methodology around how you're going to, you know, produce that product. Obviously flavor comes, you know, is really important, but I think anybody that's going to do it has to, you know, think about, you know, just assume no one knows, you know, who you are, what your product is, and why they should buy it. So, you know, I always, you know, when we were sort of exploring sort of, you know, retail hot dogs and relishes and things, you know, the most important, sort of metric that we were always sort of, you know, told was, you know, pretend that your product is on a shelf. Why is someone going to pick that one over another? And it is sort of, you know, judging a book by its cover, but, it's a tough process. And you have to find the right co-packers if you're going to go that route. And, you know, you have to then make sure they're going to execute it well. And, how it's going to get distributed. There's a lot goes into it, and there's people that are really good at just sort of focusing on that. And I think that anybody that, that does want to sort of get into the actual retail game where you're sort of, you know, getting your product distributed to a number of retailers, that, you know, just probably find an expert to help.
It's definitely challenging. And I think these chefs are finding also to, you know, with keeping their recipe and the flavor that they had in their products, to make that into a product that's, has a long shelf life and food safety certifications and all the things that it needs to be in a grocery store. You know, they have like altering the recipe to make it work, but then trying to maintain the integrity of it and what, you know, representing your brand. And I think another restaurant or that they highlighted in this piece was Levain Bakery, which everyone knows is like got a cult following for their massive cookies. And I had the owners on my show, I looked back, it was episode 205, and they're fabulous, Pam Weeks and Connie McDonald. And they've figured out how to go retail by freezing their cookies.
Yeah. Their cookies are so good. My God.
So now you can get them. I think this, it pointed out most people aren't looking for cookies in the frozen section, but FYI, that's where they are.
That's cool. Yeah, it's surprising how many things freeze well, cakes and donuts and things like that. But I think it's very hard to make money doing that unless you can get a lot of distribution and you have a product that just fits really well into retail. Because the thing you have to think about is whatever product you're putting into a store is telling another story about your brand. And if you have to, adjust the recipe so much that it is just not the same thing, what story are you telling? If it's not something that has an economy of scale where you're going to sort of, where it's financially makes sense, it's tough. It's a tough decision to decide to do that. Because it's typically not a short-term gain. And you have to be pretty well capitalized. So I always tell people to start trying to get it into local stores and, sell it, retail shops buy you first for a while and see how that goes. But Levon obviously did it the right way. I mean, getting real estate in a freezer aisle is not easy, but I'm sure, they figured that one out.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it took them a bit of time figuring out the best way to do it, but they did. And first you got to get your recipes down right and organized before you can do any of this.
Yep.
So
there you go.
There you go. Okay. It's time for my solo dining experience. So this week it's at Le Pavillon by Danielle Ballou. Here's the rundown. The location, 1 Vanderbilt Avenue, New York City, the corner of 42nd Street. It's in 1 Vanderbilt Skyscraper. It's on the ground floor and second floor, and it's adjacent to Grand Central Terminal. So the concept is a culinary oasis in the heart of Manhattan, evoking a pavillon, a festive gathering dining space surrounded by nature. The chef and owner, Danielle Ballou, it was my guest on episode 210. People want to go back and listen to that. And the co-executive chefs are Michael Balboni and Will Nassev. Corporate chef is Jean-Francois Bruel, and the corporate pastry chef is Sebastian Ruxell. So why'd I go? Well, Danielle opened a new restaurant. I mean, that's enough reason to go. My experience. So this is a hard to get reservation, and I was on Notify for Resi, and one came up at 9 p.m. on a Thursday and I for two people, and I took it. I thought it was a bit late, to go to dinner, but I have to say, actually, with the sun setting so late now, it was perfectly fine and wonderful, and I called them a day ahead and asked, or I said I was planning to come in solo and if it was okay, and they said, yes, please come. So I showed up solo. There was a bar up that had nice energy. Some people were dining there. I learned it's more for snacks. I think you can get the full menu there, but it's really more of a drinking snack bar. The place was so impressive. I was seated at a two-top at the front end of the dining room. My server, whose name happened to also be Danielle, was lovely. I selected my three courses from the set menu and sat back, relaxed. I met the maitre d', Rafiette Olian, who was so lovely and took amazing care of me. And Danielle was there and walking around the dining room, and I was able to chat with him. He sat down in the banquette with me, and we got to catch up a little bit. And so it was a really, really special experience. So what did I get? Well, I got their oysters, which are Ouvre Vanderbilt, roasted beets called Betterave Sesame, Maine lobster, Omard Cresson, and Meyer Lemon Harry's Berries Strawberries, which the dessert's called Citrone Fraise. And I also had a macchiato, and there was bread service and an initial amuse course. So what my take? Seriously, this is one of the best meals I've had in a really long time. I mean, I feel I eat very well, but sometimes you just go out and the food is even better than you expect, and just every course was amazing. I mean, the oysters were to die for. They were actually served with a spoon because they had this rich sauce with them, which I've never eaten oysters out of a shell with a spoon like that. But it was really decadent. The beets, which they had sent out, and it had this, speaking of hummus, it had the hummus in it with from Seed and Mill, and that was lovely. The lobster was divine. The dessert was fabulous. If you don't know Harry's Berries, they're the best. And so it was just an exceptional meal. The ambiance, it's fine dining with a dramatic setting. It's on the second floor, 1,000 square foot space. It has 57 foot ceilings with soaring glass windows. And I read it has 20 foot tall olive trees. They're 20 feet. And lush greenery. Half the space is a garden. It's really quite something. And when I looked, I was at the banquet. When I looked over to the left past the bar, I could see the Chrysler Building out the window, which was really cool. And at the end of the meal, I got a tour of the kitchen. This is beautiful, huge kitchen. Really nice. So I'd say it's perfect for a special meal out, not necessarily for a special occasion. Interesting tidbit. One Vanderbilt is a 67-floor skyscraper, and it's now the fourth tallest building in New York City, and it's going to have an observation deck called Summit opening in October, so check that out. Personal fun fact. So back when I had Danielle on my show, it was March 2019, and my fun fact is he was talking with, I think, his manager or director of operations about what chairs they should be putting into this new restaurant. So that was 2 years ago. And I think he was working on this project for 4 years. And I sat in the banquet and I realized I didn't even get to try the chair. So next time I go back, I want to try a chair, see what he picked out. Okay, so the cost of my meal, it was $125 for three courses. That's not including tax and gratuity. They very graciously surprised me and comped my meal. I was not expecting it. So I just want to say thank you so much. It was a treat and I can't wait to come back. And that's the answer to my next question. Would I go back? Of course. It's wonderful. I highly recommend it. And their website is lepavillon.com and Instagram lepavillon. So there you go. Josh, did I sell it?
My God, I want to go now. change up my reservation for next.
your next date night.
Yep. That sounds amazing. I've heard only like killer things about it. And I think it's just like just what you know we need coming out of the pandemic is a restaurant like that opening. So.
Yeah, it was great because also I mean I have to say it's fine dining, but it's not. At the same time, it's kind of casual, you know.
Well, the bill wasn't. I mean, that's not a bad bill either. You know, you said 125.
Yeah, 125, and it's a three course menu, and you pick, you select, and yeah, I thought so too. It's for what you're getting. It's definitely a good value. Okay, so for the final question, my next guest is Judy Ann Wu. She's an independent marketing and culinary consultant working with brands both big and small. And she's the host of Food People Are the Best People, which is a new podcast on the Eat, Drink, Dine podcast network. And I was recently her guest on episode 5. It is out there in the universe if people want to find it. Josh, please ask a question for Judy Ann.
You know, and I'm glad I just saw this as well. I think I would probably ask her a similar question as to how does she go about finding new clients?
I will find out. Yeah, she's Judy Ann's based in Portland, Oregon. And yeah, we became friends because we just have similar taste and or desires, but yeah, I will find out because that's a good question.
Yeah, I always find with consultants, we work with a lot of consultants and I'm always curious how they, you know, it typically tends to be word of mouth, but I'm always interested to hear if they have like their own unique approach to it.
Yeah. Well, I will find out.
All right.
And that's the show. So thank you so much for joining me. I'm impressed with everything you've accomplished. I can't wait to see all the things you're going to do next. And definitely am excited with Mies. I feel, we got to get all my clients on board.
Well, it was such a pleasure chatting with you, Sherry. And thanks again for having me. This was really fun.
You're very welcome. So thank you. My guest today has been Josh Sharkey. He's the founder and CEO of Mies, the recipe tool for professional chefs. Their website is getmies.com. That's getmeez.com. And you can follow Josh and his company on social media at Josh L. Sharkey and at GetMies. You can follow me at Sherry Bayer at Bayer PR and at All Industry. My Facebook page is All in the Industry. My websites, BayerPublicRelations.com, SherryBayer.com, and AllInTheIndustry.com. All of our shows are archived at HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We are also on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. Thanks to my engineer today, Amanda Wang. Thanks again to Josh. And thanks also to lovely Elise Porter. I'm Sherry Bayer. I'll be back next week with a new show. I hope you'll tune in then. Stay safe and well, and thank you for being part of All in the Industry. Bye. All in the Industry is powered by Simplecast. I'm Sherry Bayer, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, HRN is celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.